You're listening to The Music Show on RN. It's time to talk to Sarah Collins. She's the recipient, as I mentioned, of the prestigious 2019 Macready Musicological Award, named after the late Andrew Macready. And she is Senior Lecturer in Musicology at the University of Western Australia Conservatorium of Music. But what does a musicologist actually do? It's time we knew. Let's begin with a little Tchaikovsky, sort of. Well, it's barely Tchaikovsky at all anymore. That's the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy from the Nutcracker, but you will possibly recognise it in its Tetris form there. It's a way, I suppose, of introducing a musicologist. Sarah Collins, welcome to The Music Show.
Thanks for having me.
And congratulations on this award. And maybe I could ask you a very general question, because I don't think I've ever asked this question on the music show. What is musicology?
It almost sounds like a made-up word, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It sounds like an opportunistic word, sort of add music and add ology. But it is literally just the study of music. And, of course, people have been thinking about music for thousands of years, since the time of Plato and before. But it took until the 19th century for it to be consolidated into a discipline, and that really relied on a particular conception of the work as something that was different from its function or its context. So we needed to wait until the 19th century when they started to abstract music from other things, you know, daily life, politics, the church, and think of it more as a sort of natural object that could be investigated scientifically, if you like, you know, that had universal laws that could be extracted from its function.
So this coincides with the invention of the public concert hall, really, and in fact the idea of the notion of classical music.
Yes, the notion of not only classical music, but a standard repertoire. So you think about for this time, the idea of turning up to church every week and hearing the same cantata, that would just be, you know, unheard of, or turning up to even the opera and hearing the same work again. You know, what am I paying for if I'm not paying for something new? Whereas now, concert organisers really have to struggle to get the audiences to come in to hear new works. They want to hear that standard repertoire. But the idea of standard repertoire is only a couple of hundred years old, and it did rely on this idea that a musical work was bounded by the score, and the score was the thing that you passed on to the next generation, and they interpreted it and they poured over it. And so the music became something that used to be in performance, used to be in the community, but all of a sudden was locked in to this text. And then, you know, people could come along and say, well, if it's a text, we can unpick it and treat it like a scientific object. And it was related to a whole lot of other institutional things that were happening in German universities. There was funding for the natural sciences. So anybody interested in music history basically had to make the argument that this was a, you know, we could look at this human product almost as an object of natural science. And that's why you get so much music analysis, so much unpicking of, you know, the detail of structures of music in that early period of musicology. But we've come a long way since then.
We've come as far as Tetris, in fact, and even further. But we'll leave Tetris to one side. We'll leave it hanging tantalisingly and talk perhaps first of all about what musicology embraces. On the one hand, I suppose you've answered the question that it's an analytical, that it's people taking up a score of Beethoven, say, and pulling it apart, like you might take a car engine apart to see what it's made up of. But on the other extreme, or the other end of the spectrum, history, sociology, biography?
Yes. And performance. And performance. So you have this idea that, one, yes, like a car, you know, things work together, and if the whole system functions well, then you can sort of break it up into smaller parts and see how each part relates to the whole system. So the idea of teleology, you know, each part working logically for the purpose of a coherent whole, and that was what was prized at that particular time. But, you know, the whole history of musical composition since that time, the political upheaval, the compositional change, the kind of compositional change wrought by technological change as well, how people treated music differently, treated it more as a sound material rather than, via the laws of harmony and whatnot. So that kind of compositional change also required a change of view of what music was, how it could function in society, and what it sort of reflected about human consciousness under certain political regimes, under conditions of modernity. And so, yes, you have psychology, you have cognitive sciences coming in, you have sociology, anthropology, linking up with ethnomusicology and the interest in non-Western cultures. I don't want to give the impression of the West and the rest. We're trying to get away from this very much. So the Western canon and, these other things, we've got to think of it much more holistically in terms of humans performing and interacting with sonorous material. So this is where we're at now, where we have performers alongside historians, alongside of anthropologists. And it's a really exciting time to be in the field.
And who do you work for, do you think, as a musicologist? Are you working on behalf of other academics or on behalf of audiences or on behalf of music itself?
Can I give a completely naff response to this question? Completely naff. I honestly believe, and this is going to sound disingenuous, but I believe that the people working in the humanities are working for humanity. People talk about the ivory tower of the university and trying to make the university into something that functions for the real world. And it's true that a lot of universities are, created by acts of parliament. They need to serve the community. They should be serving the community. But at the same time, the whole point of the university is that it's not part of the real world. It's not part of the corporate world, the commercial world, well, it shouldn't be, or part of the political world. It's meant to be a space where we discover new knowledge about humans and their environment. I don't want to be anthropocentric here, but humans and their environment and their productions and the way they, just understanding ourselves, essentially. And so I think when people study music, it is studying a forms of aesthetic expression that reveals something about humans interacting and their self-knowledge.
You're listening to The Music Show on RN, and my guest is Dr. Sarah Collins, who has just taken out the 2019 Macready Musicological Award, and we thought it was an opportunity to talk about what musicology is and what it can do. Wilfred Mellers is an important figure here, it seems to me at least, because from about the 1960s on, he was opening up musicological inquiry to include things like the Beatles, for example, and Bob Dylan and the blues. And not that he was necessarily the first to do this, but perhaps he was the first to do it in the context of an otherwise classical music department. And he was a leaverside. He was very much music in society. But he also said, and I've often thought about this and quoted it, in fact, that if you're not talking technically about music, you're not talking about music at all. You're talking about something else. Do you have sympathy with that point of view? And are you aware that some of the time you're talking about history and some of the time you're talking about sociology and psychology and some of the time you're just talking about the dots?
This is a great question. The first thing is about Mellers. Mellers was a fantastic eccentric. And he was of his time, obviously, as you say, but also somebody who was within the establishment but anti-establishment and pushing from the inside in all sorts of incredibly interesting ways. And you read his work now and it's still so alive. So he's definitely an important figure. In terms of this, this is a key question about, when you're studying the history of music, is it separate from the analysis of music? And if you think back to the origins of musicology as a discipline, as I said, in the around 1880s, you have someone like Guido Adler, who's seen as the, one of the grandfathers of musicology, who comes and says, look, we've got this thing called systematic musicology over here, and then this other thing which is historical stuff. So we're going to look at the history, and then all the other stuff is going to be sort of bound up with, analysis and the object itself. So he wanted those two things separate, as you're saying, that, these two things would stand in separate areas. You'd have historical musicology that'd be concerned with collecting ideas about composers' lives, collecting information, about composers' lives and the professional situation that they were in and the society, social structures, performance contexts, audience response, reception history, all of that would go under history. And then we'd have this other thing over here, which is, you know, analysis and picking things out and discovering aesthetics, essentially. So this was seen as abstracted over here. And, I mean, I think this is, again, a result of thinking of music as being notes on a page rather than a living sonorous activity that's completely embedded within people's lives. And I think the Tetris example that we opened with is a great example of that, that the Sugar Plum Fairy, the dance of Sugar Plum Fairy in that context provides a kind of sonic backdrop to the player's experience. So you're sitting there playing Tetris, you're focusing on trying to get the, you know, the blocks in the right spot, and then you have this kind of thing going on in the background. That is just pleasant, right? It's just pleasant to some people.
I was going to say.
but what's interesting about that is that from a musicological angle, you can see that this sonic backdrop that doesn't enter the consciousness of a normal player bears a trace of the history of that particular game, being born in behind the Iron Curtain in the early 1980s, and then being brought up by Nintendo and being brought out on the Game Boy, Nintendo Game Boy, in the same year that the Berlin Wall begins to come down, and all of the Russian-Soviet iconography that was so much a part of that game in its initial manifestation was anglicised and expunged and sanitised, and you got rid of it all. So in the Nintendo version, all you see is the building of St. Basil's building there, and then but you have no hammer and sickle, you have no Russian lettering, and then you have this Tchaikovsky that comes in secretly in the background as a trace, and there's also another level that you play which has another Russian folk tune in it. And so even though it's been completely Americanized in our contemporary experience, it bears this trace of a history in the sonic footprint, which I find really interesting. I mean, there's this question about, does it matter? You know, you're there, you're playing, it's nice, whatever. But it's the same question of, you know, whether you go to London. Can you go to London and eat a curry and not think about the history of imperialism? Yes, you can. You know, you can enjoy this curry in London without thinking of why it's there and the history of, you know, imperial conquest. But the fact is it's a trace that shows the movement of people, the movements of objects, and that trace opens up a whole historical world that would otherwise be occluded. So you have a sonic trace that's opening a window into a whole level of interpretation that reveals the movement of people, etc. If we imagine music and all human expression, you know, manifestations of human expression, art, literature, etc., to be a reflection of other bits of life, then we take away any radical potential of that art form. And so one of the purposes of an aesthetic view of music, the idea of aesthetic autonomy or the autonomy of music that was so widespread in the early 20th century but has now become very unpopular. So the idea of thinking of music as being autonomous, namely somehow separate from our everyday lives, is quite a powerful idea that I think we need to hold on to. And the reason why I bring that up in relation to notation is that that idea of music existing beyond the performance, beyond the community in which it was created, actually has a function with respect to how we can think of this as being a potential form of expression that can really have a radical potential with respect to how we live our lives. It means that we don't just sort of continue on under the pressure of power structures, under the pressure of self-conditioning, under the pressures of, you know, corporate advertising and all that. We're not just spinning out our lives in a deterministic way, like a clock that is wound up and just, you know, winds down in a determined way. That something like music gives us a little glimpse of some radical alternative, some potential of beyond that. So I think that's, we need to hold on to that autonomy just a little bit longer
But it also makes, I mean, we're talking about classical music here at this point, but I mean, this seems to me to be a tension between the score and the performance, and we don't want to lose that, do we? There's that Schnabel quote, Arthur Schnabel, the great Beethoven interpreter who said there is no performance of a Beethoven sonata as great as the sonata itself.
Itself, yes. It's like, I mean, this is the thing with the text as well, is that you hand it on to future generations to interpret. I mean, this is why it was set up. You know, we have this narrative of the dual styles of this particular period, where you have Beethoven and Rossini, and you think of them as being equally, at the time, they were equally held in high regard. But now, of course, it's all Beethoven, because we happened to have developed historically to prize something that can be handed on, a text that can be handed on like a volume, like the object itself. And Rossini, on the other hand, represented the event, the performance event, the liveness. You know, he chopped and changed versions. So, I mean, you get this even when you go to an operatic production now. If you go to a concert performance of Beethoven's symphony, you want it to sound a certain way. If you go to, that accords with your expectations to a certain degree. If you go to an opera performance, they can't get away with doing the same production. Sure, it'll sound, the music will be there, the voices will be there, the interpretation will be within a bounded, you know, set of conventions, performance conventions that we have now, but the production will be different, the costumes will be different. You know, so the fact that opera is seen as a script, as sort of prompt to a creation, whereas a score is seen as a text that must be slavishly followed. And so, these type of things are very 19th century, and they lingered well into the 20th century, and musicology is only just kind of, you know, unearthing itself from the legacy of that dual thing of, you know, some music is meant to just be live and without text. I mean, you mentioned Milford Mellers and how radical it was for him to bring in the Beatles. I mean, the reason why popular music didn't come in for so long into the Academy was this idea that it was seen as more of a performance-oriented form of expression. And we were here, you know, seriously studying texts. And so, it requires some kind of radical change in one's mind about what music actually is, where it exists, and how it comes to be.
On today's music show, we're talking musicology with Dr. Collins from the University of Western Australia. Maybe we should, you mentioned Beethoven symphonies, we should work our way towards listening to some music by way of concluding our conversation. And I want to play some of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, but let's talk about that piece. You brought up the subject earlier of reception history. What's that?
Reception history is essentially I'm just thinking in the simplest terms, the idea of how people, audiences, received particular works, what meanings they attributed to particular works over time, how these meanings changed. And so, I mean, again, we begin with this Tetris example and the types of experiences, meanings and communal norms that would have conditioned the audience response to that in its initial manifestation, the Nutcracker Suite. Is obviously entirely different to how it's like it's afterlives, it's ghostly afterlives as it appears, you know.
Well, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony has a fascinating reception history, doesn't it? I mean, really from the start, but along the way becoming the national anthem of Rhodesia and the anthem of the European Union, to name just two. How does this affect the way we listen to a piece like the last movement of the Ninth Symphony?
Yeah, I mean, this is a similar question to, you know, the question that people ask about Wagner. You know, can you listen to Wagner and not think about his anti-Semitism, and how much do we need to take into account previous, you know, performance histories of particular works, and as well as, you know, composer biographies? How does this affect? I mean, I think it's this idea of, you know, if you enjoy music, you need to just, you know, be allowed to do that. At the end of the day, you know, enjoy that curry that you're eating in London without feeling the burden of imperial history. You know, enjoy playing Tetris without thinking about, you know, Soviet atrocities. But I think it's the job of anybody who wants to understand music as a window into history and into the human psyche and to formation, the way identities form and the way that people become attached to certain ideas like, a skepticism of experts, a skepticism of intellectuals, you know, and certain music being attached to, you know, attached to those sort of tropes in human history. So I think we need to understand how, even though some music may seem quite innocent and lovely and joyous and to us now, that there's also it's also important to look a little bit deeper, scratch beneath the surface to what that trace reveals about a whole history of movement and not always savoury implications.
No, not much of which really can be sheeted home to Beethoven, but particularly he's hardly responsible for the fact that when you listen to a recording like the one that I'm about to play, we're listening to Furtwängler conducting the Berlin Philharmonic in 1942, and in the audience is Hitler and Goering. Yes. And Goebbels, and that's something else that's very hard to put out of your mind, isn't it, if you know. But if you don't know, of course, it doesn't matter.
Yes, all of a sudden you can't not see that context and not understand what that would have meant. You know, what those particular, you know, soaring sonorities and lush harmonies and affirming rhythms would have meant to in that context. And it almost feels a little bit dirty, but but you know, I mean, I think at the end of the day too, that new meanings can be forged just as they how they have in the past as well. We can't forge new meanings with while you know, putting the past aside. We can't, for example, I mean, it's the same issue as whether a hip-hop artist can treat, you know, and a hip-hop artist can sort of appropriate, you know, use some didgeridoo music or some other, you know, music that they don't have a cultural sort of association with. Can we treat music and sound as being mere material for us to, you know, respond to or use in a new composition? You know, now we're getting much more mixing. So, you know, Beethoven's, you know, Ninth Symphony, the fourth movement, would exist as an MP3, and we can grab part of that, and we can even grab just the bottom line, you know, and mix it into something else. And so at what point does it become just material sort of fodder for the next creation, as opposed to this thing, this creation, this whole work that has a history all its own? I think we've got to think much more plurally about, and especially now we can't avoid it with digital sharing and mixing, much more plurally about sort of musical material performance contexts and how these all interact in a very complex and non-transparent way. And it's part of the job of a musicologist to unpick.
I was just about to point that out. This is, the ball is in your court. Sarah Collins, thank you very much indeed for being my guest on The Music Show, and congratulations again on the prize.
Thanks for having me, Andy.
And those are the closing bars of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, conducted by Wilhelm Furtwängler, the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra and the Bruno Kittel Chorus, on the 19th of April 1942, a concert in honour of Hitler's birthday. And it's hard not to hear that applause and picture the audience. That's it for today. Tomorrow on The Music Show at the same time, the Australian String Quartet performs Nigel Westlake, and we take a trip round a new exhibition that's opened in Sydney. It's called Songs of Home, and it looks at the kind of music and listens to the kind of music that would have been heard in the early days of the colony of New South Wales.